Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined today by Reaction columnist, geopolitical expert, best-selling author, Tim Marshall. Tim, welcome. We're obviously going to talk primarily about, well, only one subject, which is the story unfolding in Israel, started on Saturday morning, and we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. A lot has happened there. Just to begin, bring us up to date. What's your assessment of where we are?
In uncharted territory. I mean, forgive me, that's not That is common perception, common wisdom, and it's not wrong. It's uncharted territory because despite what a lot of people say, Israel actually keeps the gloves on most times, and they're going to come off this time. In fact, perhaps you could argue they already have. Also this time, if you go forward from, say, 1973, and you look at things like the invasion of Lebanon in 82, the two intifadas, the Gaza fighting in 2014 and 2021, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't really threaten to drag in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Well, sorry, apart from 82, what I mean is it didn't really risk sparking a much wider war. This does. It's at the margins, but you can even go as far as of having a scenario where Iran is dragged into this. So the next few days are really crucial. This is why the Americans have sent the USS Gerald Ford, the aircraft carrier strike group, into the Eastern Mediterranean. It's now in position as a warning to say to the wider world, don't get involved.
So how would it escalate, do you think? And you mentioned Iran, obviously central to the story, critical supporters of Hamas,
yes.
But not confirmed. And some reports that Iran was directly involved in planning the operation in southern Israel on Saturday morning, but not confirmed yet. How could you get to the escalation stage where Iran is directly involved in the war?
Partially the law of unintended consequences, which it often applies in warfare. It's interesting to date that the Iranian government celebrates the atrocities, but doesn't say it is involved. Hamas has thanked it for supplying it with its weapons, but hasn't said it planned it. The Israelis have not directly pointed the finger, not directly, at Iran. And that tells us that actually Iran is saying to its friends in the region, Hezbollah and Hamas, you know, we don't actually want to get dragged into this at this point. Mm-hmm. But how could it come about? Hamas, if there's a ground war and Hamas is going to be completely and utterly destroyed, that's a big blow for the Iranians. If the death toll on the Palestinian side rises to such an extent that Hezbollah in Lebanon, also paid for and armed by Iran, feels it has to enter the conflict, then that's actually a war between Israel and Lebanon. Israel has put Hezbollah on notice that since it joined the government, unlike the 2006 Hezbollah-Israel war, if it happens again, because they're in government, they will consider themselves at war with Lebanon. Next door is Syria, and Iran has a lot of assets in Syria, and Israel will have to target them as well. One of the very well-trained brigades inside Syria that's controlled by Iran is already mobilized and moved up to the border. So once you've got that far, you are a much closer step towards then Iran becoming involved as well. And if it becomes public that Iran actually trained and carried out and helped directly these attacks, then pressure mounts on Israel to act against it. So there's a lot of steps then, and we're not there. But, you know, things can easily get out of control. Now, we are talking, as you said, on Wednesday, and I'm looking at reports already that there's been some sort of air infiltration out of Lebanon and into Israel. The sirens are sounding in the cities all across it. in a confused situation of whether it's drones, paragliders, who knows what. But it's the sort of incident which you know can get out of control, can drag in another country. Again, a lot of things are in these situations, while things are still in control, are calibrated. And I looked at the response to date of Hezbollah. And yes, they've fired some rockets. Yes, they've made some noises. But to the extent that they are saying we stand with our brothers Hamas, but not to the extent that they're actually going to get dragged in yet. The Israelis, for their part, some people think they should actually take a preemptive strike on Hezbollah. That, I think, is unlikely, but they were waiting for a couple of things. One, the USS Gerald Ford to arrive on station, and two, for them to get tens of thousands, minimum tens of thousands of troops up to the north to make absolutely sure that if something there does happen, they're not going to be overrun. And that finally leads to the last bit of the jigsaw of the Hezbollah logic, short of them actually triggering a full-out war. If they skirmish on the border, they make absolutely sure that tens of thousands of Israeli troops, including special forces and commando troops, are there and not on the Gaza border, where they would actually be needed for ground fighting.
So we'll talk in a moment, if it's okay, about the origins of this conflict and how we got here. But just on your point there about Israel potentially having to fight on several fronts, even if Iran doesn't directly come into the war or Israel doesn't directly attack Iran, tell us a bit about Israeli capabilities. Does it have sufficient capabilities to fight on two or three fronts simultaneously with incursions from different angles?
It does, but it really, really complicates it matters. And it also dilutes the real specialist forces that they have. I mean, you know, you want to put most of your special forces into Gaza if you're going to go in on, at some point, either in full force all the way to the sea, which I don't think is a fait accompli at the moment. A lot of people are saying there is no way they're not going to go, you know, all in. They well might, but I think there are still restraining factors. And you don't want your special forces split in that manner. Nevertheless, they have upwards of 400,000 people under arms, most of them with experience. So they do have enough to be on the border with Gaza. They actually do need to keep an eye on the Egyptian border, but not because of Egypt, but because there are forces in Egypt that could try and come across. Mm-hmm. They need to be in force up in Lebanon. They need to be across the part of the Golan, which faces Syria. And they need to be in the West Bank, because that could very easily go up in flames. I mean, most people haven't noticed because of the enormity of what has happened on the Gaza-Israeli border, but at least 15 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in the past few days. So, you know, the last thing the Israelis want is to be having to deal with all those situations simultaneously.
Tell us a bit about the map. You've written extensively about maps and how geography shapes history and shapes geopolitics. What's the origin of this conflict? Because a lot of listeners won't necessarily be across all of the history. I mean, it is a very confusing picture, and you sometimes hear some extraordinary things stated as reality when the subject of the State of Israel is up for discussion. But what's the root of it?
I could start with the Book of Genesis, but I won't. Let's say about 1900, the Zionist movement has been formed. There is a feeling which grows amongst the diaspora that, you know, after centuries of being away from the homeland, it's time for people to go back, and they start going back to join the existing Jewish community, which has never left, but it was only in the tens of thousands in the early part of the last century. All the land that they went to was bought. They paid for it. But as the numbers grow, the local populations get angry about this, feel that they are being squeezed out. There is, of course, the religious divide. Most of the people coming to join the Middle Eastern Jews are European Jews and are therefore seen as real outsiders. You can fast forward through various problems, but let's fast forward to 1948. The British have had enough of it. The UN agrees there'll be a partition, there'll be a state for Palestine, state for Israel. Israel says yes, Palestine says no, all the Arab countries say no, there's a war. Israel survives. Fast forward again through various bits of history, 67 war. At this point, Israel extends massively the territory it controls. And each time the Palestinians and Arabs fight, there is usually ends up with less land for the Palestinians. And so it was in 67, the Sinai, Gaza, Jerusalem, and the West Bank. Jordan occupied the West Bank until 67. After that, Israel occupied it. All the way to 73, and now the Israelis are taking the Golan Heights from Syria. There's the intifadas, et cetera, et cetera. And that all the time from the 80s, the settlements are being built in the West Bank. And every settlement that is built, there is less room for the Palestinians and the less possibility of a contiguous state. They live in desperate poverty, many of them. They live under the brutality of their own leadership, and they live under occupation in the West Bank, and they did live under occupation in Gaza until the Israelis pulled out. Again, if you take the Palestinian view on this, they say they are still occupied because there is a blockade. Now, there is a partial blockade on Gaza. Right, I'll try to get to the present. Sorry about that lengthy.
No. I wanted to go back a little. I mean, also in the middle of that very clear description, there's the Holocaust, and there are the events in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s, which mean that many people who had perhaps been sceptical of Zionism or the need for an Israeli state came to the view that, you know, the Jews who had been pursued and pogromed across across Europe required a state, and that becomes the sort of settled view of the international community post Holocaust, doesn't it? That's what drives the process in the mid to late 40s.
It does, and of course, increasing numbers, which of course, from the Palestinian perspective, they feel they're being pushed even further. And again, they regard these as European settlers. But actually, it is worth mentioning the Holocaust, because if you want to understand the visceral reaction to this inside Israel, with the stories we know of the brutality of, you know, children being ripped from their mothers, mothers murdered, people kidnapped, men separated, you know, well, we all know the stories. That there is an immediate echo for every Israeli of the Holocaust, of the thought of never again. And I don't think outsiders can really understand that visceral feeling, which of course is going to drive part of the passion for revenge. It's not a word I like to use. You know, you're supposed to think of justice, not vengeance. But I think that in Israel, they have gone beyond that now, that they must strike back incredibly hard, and they must take revenge in order for it not to happen again. I'm not arguing the rights and wrongs of it. I'm trying to explain the desperation and the depth of the feeling that there is about that sort of barbarity that they have just suffered. So, sorry, to get right up to date, the Middle East has also changed. Over the decades, there were various pogroms against the Middle Eastern Jews in places like Yemen and Iraq. And so hundreds of thousands of them were effectively ethnically cleansed out of the Arab countries. And they came to live in Israel. And so there is a slight split in Israeli Jewish society between the ones of European, although originally Middle Eastern heritage, but European heritage, yeah. and the ones that are Middle Eastern heritage. The other thing that's happened in the Middle East, and this is only in the past 3 or 4 years, is that after Jordan and Egypt making peace with Israel, under the Abraham Accords, several Arab countries have made their peace, including Bahrain, the UAE, Sudan and Morocco. And it looked very likely that within, let's say, a year, but the Americans thought they could get this over the line by Christmas, Saudi Arabia was going to recognize the state of Israel, because they're almost natural allies in one way. Economically, they could do amazing things together, the way that the UAE and Israel are doing amazing things economically together. And there's all sorts of things about sharing port facilities and having a huge industrial area that they would share with Jordan. And this whole Middle East economic corridor that was announced at the G20 would also connect them. Well, Iran can't stand for that.
Yes, it's a strategic disaster for Iran if such a deal is struck.
Yes, because despite them making up a little bit recently, the Chinese brokered a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, both of whom regard themselves as the keepers of God's plan for the world when it comes to Islam. The revolutionaries in Tehran believe that God wants them all to be Shia, and the Saudi royal family, the custodians of the two holy places, think that God's plan is for everyone to be Sunni. So they are very much divided to that, as well as one being Persian and one being Arabic. So despite this recent rapprochement, they are actually still, at the very least, competitors. And the idea for Iran that its two greatest problems that it thinks it has in the Middle East, one is Saudi Arabia and the other is Israel, are going to come together, is as you say, Martin, a strategic disaster for them. So that is why there's 100% a motive for Tehran to be in some way behind this. Well, they are in some way behind this. Whether they ordered it, that is another matter. But they are the ones who pay at least $100 million a year to Hamas, and they don't spend it on hospitals, and they're the ones that arm them. Now, I've been in Gaza a few times, and one time I was walking past a car showroom, and it was just loads of really nice, shiny, brand new cars, because there's a whole strata of Gazan society that dines out in fancy restaurants, goes to the swimming pools, in the nice hotels, the beachfront restaurant, etc., in the shopping malls. It's all in one particular area, and it's just full of Hamas. You know, they are the elite. And I thought, where are all these cars coming from? I mean, of course, I knew about the tunnels. And eventually, I was taken to a tunnel and I managed to look down it. Wasn't allowed in it. And this guy gave me a video, thinking it was really, really funny, you know. And it was of a tractor towing a Mercedes Benz through the tunnels. So the point I'm making is that if you can put a Mercedes Benz through a tunnel, you can put a large rocket through it as well.
Mm. You're listening to The Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. I'm talking to Tim Marshall, columnist for Reaction. If you want to read Tim's weekly column on geopolitics for Reaction and my weekly newsletter on politics, geopolitics, economics, culture, then become a subscriber to Reaction. You go to the site www.reaction.life. You get all that, and you also get the daily briefing from our team. So, Tim, onto the geopolitical implications. What are the implications in terms of the US and the US election next year? Yeah. Because the Biden administration has pursued a particular policy on Iran, friend of Hamas, that is criticized by Donald Trump and by Republicans and by others as having been weak to the point of, well, the A word is sometimes used, appeasement, and Biden's team have been trying to normalize relations or get back to a position closer to the one that was adopted by President Obama when he was in charge. How do you think this plays out?
It's a massive headache for the Biden team. He thought in election year he might be able to get this, what would have been an historic deal between Saudi and Israel, you know, the Jewish state shaking hands with the owners of the custodians of the two holy places, two holy mosques. What an achievement that would have been in election year. It's at the very least on hold. It's a real problem in election year because, you know, there are a number of Jewish voters in the United States, and there are a number of Muslim voters in the United States, and they are going to be, as most of them, as split as everybody else. So that's a fine line that you have to tread. Also the reaching out to Iran will probably come to a halt. Now, Biden handed over about $6 billion. I don't think appeasement, I think it's too harsh a word. I think this was a genuine attempt to bring Iran to the negotiating table, to open up its nuclear facilities, to try to prevent them from getting a working nuclear bomb. But, you know, it's pretty hard to see how they're going to keep going on that track. So, of course, there's another, you could argue, foreign policy failure. And Mr. Trump, of course, is going to make hay with this. I mean, I don't think he's been out yet, but I think he'll be saying, hey, Sleepy Joe gave them all the money to fund this massacre. He will campaign along those lines.
And the
in the wider Middle East.
The reality, Tim, is that the $6 billion, of course, has not been, so to say, directly spent on weapons. It's sitting in a Qatari bank account, so it's not yet been fully transferred to the Iranian regime. Nonetheless, it's the impression, not the $6 billion, but the attempt to normalize relations, it makes it look, and it makes it very easy for the Republicans to make the case, and others as well, that the administration has been conned, that the Iranians, even if they were not directly involved in the planning of this operation, this appalling assault on Israel on Saturday morning, even if there wasn't direct involvement in that, there was encouragement and very close links, obviously, between Hamas and the Iranians. And it adds to the impression, doesn't it, that the Biden administration was somehow naive. That will be the Republican charge.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, I should have been more clear on the account and how that deal was done. But yes, your point is the correct overall one, that it's the way it looks to the electorate, and the clear ammunition that it gives to the Republicans to say, you know, this is what happens when you suck with the devil with such a short spoon. And it will be part of the foreign policy debate, because this story in the United States is a massive story. So it's a problem. And the Americans have got another problem. They have, I wouldn't say they've given carte blanche to the Israelis to do take whatever measures are deemed necessary, but they have not even really said from the very top, you know, please keep the gloves on. Mm. Now, there's a finite period, and I don't know how long it is, 1 week, 3 weeks. But at a certain point, as the Palestinian civilian death toll mounts and worldwide horror at that horror, and it will be, mounts, that the Americans at some point will feel they have to step in and say, you know, we need to do something about this. Again, I'm not talking about the rights and wrongs of this. I'm talking about how the way the things play out in these scenarios. Hmm. So, where is the American reputation if we get to 3 weeks and 14,000 dead, or whatever it's going to be in the Arab world? Where is it elsewhere? Who are they talking to? What do they do when people are imploring them to use whatever persuasive powers they have? So they are going to face extremely difficult questions in the next few weeks. The Saudis, I think, will simply park the negotiations. They cannot be seen in this climate to be dealing with the Israelis and Americans on this deal. The UAE's deal with Israel could come under some mm-hmm. strain, depending on how bad things get. And it's, you know, if things do spiral completely out of control, you're even looking at Jordan and Egypt reconsidering their options. So this is a dilemma for the Israelis that, you know, they can't do nothing. If they do nothing, they'll be seen to be weak, and they will just get more coming at them. If they do what other people regard as too much, then they're going to run into those problems as well. They are damned if they do, and they're damned if they don't. And it's a hellish decision that they have to make. It's why, actually, one of the reasons why, although I think a ground offensive is certainly one of the very plausible scenarios, Netanyahu is actually relatively risk averse on this. He knows the death toll will soar on the ground. He knows how many the Israelis will lose, huge numbers of troops in such a fight. So for the moment, he's in a position to attack. He's got his troops in the north now. The Americans have arrived on the scene. But I think that we have a bit more air power to go before before that ground offensive would or wouldn't be ordered in. Oh, by the way, another thing that we haven't dealt with so far is the Rafah crossing.
Mm.
That's the border crossing with Egypt. It's closed because it got some collateral damage from an airstrike nearby it. There's going to be huge pressure on the Egyptians to open the Rafah crossing and let out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to set up prefabricated living quarters for them somewhere over the border and to be helped doing that. But Egypt really doesn't want to do that. It does not want several hundred thousand people piling out of the Gaza. But you know, that is another factor that we have to look for.
Just on Netanyahu, he's not a natural, despite his rhetorical position, he's not a natural war leader in terms of experience.
Isn't it? Because of his reputation, everyone just sort of thinks, you know, he's this sort of incredible warmonger. Now, he is definitely, without any question, right of centre. He does talk extremely toughly, but his actual actions are usually a bit less than his rhetoric. You could say the same thing for Trump. Trump came into power and half the world was saying, oh, there's going to be wars here and wars there, and there weren't.
Mm.
And it's pretty much the same with Netanyahu. Interesting thing happened shortly before we began recording is the coalition government that they've now... Sorry, all Israeli governments are coalition government, but they've put together a wartime cabinet. And it consists pretty much of three people, the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, the current Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, and they've brought in Benny Gantz. Now, Benny Gantz is a very senior opposition figure, and he's also a former Defence Minister, and he's also, I think from memory, a former general with combat experience. And when you get combat-experienced politicians in very high positions, often they are the most sober of the people around the table, because they know the price that has to be paid. So it'll be interesting to see what Gantz's position is as we move forward over the next few days.
How do you evaluate this extraordinary intelligence failure that enabled this barbaric attack to happen?
We have to go back partially to what we were just talking about with the Abraham Accords. And it, you know, things look okay, and we're even talking to the Saudis, and okay, it's so quiet on the southern front, as the Israelis call it, along Gaza. They actually had reissued work permits. You know, people say, nothing gets in and out of Gaza. It's rubbish. 300 trucks go in on a frequent basis, absolutely full of food and things. Not anymore. And again, I'm not trying to talk about the rights and wrongs of it. It's just that, you know, it's just factually incorrect to say nothing goes in and out. And recently, 20,000 workers a day were going in and out, working in Israel and taking back money, which was helping the Palestinian economy. Of course, that's now come to an end. Sorry, but the reason I mention that is that because that was the climate in which this attack took place, they were thinking, okay, it's nice and calm. Here's the work permits. The skirmishing that there was mostly from Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Lion's Den inside Gaza, not from Hamas.
Mm.
So they completely took their eye off the ball. 70% of the IDF on active service were in the West Bank on Saturday morning. Of the 30% that were on active service, well, some of them are up north, some are on the Egyptian border, some of them are elsewhere. A lot of them were on leave. A lot of them were given the day off because it was the Sabbath. And it was the end of a Jewish a holiday, and so they were a skeleton staff. I mean, it's in retrospect, it's amazing. So that's the first thing about how it happened. Then there's the intelligence failure, and the speculation is that this time Hamas, knowing that the Israelis are deep inside Gaza with various assets, they may have to put the whole thing together on paper. No telephone calls. No emails, no scratch, just paper and meetings, because it's that people have been tracking back, and there have been several meetings in Lebanon between Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iranian officials, which, you know, they can keep quiet there. So then there's the last bit, and that's that if you put together this, and if your eye is off the ball, then the manner of the strike was stunning. They've never seen anything like this. First of all, the drones came over and they bombed the communication towers. So suddenly, the Israelis were deaf and blind and mute. So their bases are getting attacked on along the border fence, and they can't actually radio out because the whole comms towers went down. That was the first thing they did. Then over come these paragliders, which again is something completely new, and how they trained that is going to be interesting. Then once they realized they were causing havoc and the IDF was under strength, they cut through the fence. Now, normally you go within 100 yards of the fence and you risk getting shot.
Hmm.
Now, anyone that might be shooting you is busy fighting off, 100 fighters are coming at you and there's only 10 of you. So up come the bulldozers, plow through the fence, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of operatives then run through it. So you put all that together and you can see how it can happen. But I tell you, at the end of this, at the very least, deputy heads are going to roll.
Well, I was going to ask you what the implications are for Netanyahu. In the short term, he's prime minister, as you said. There's a new, effectively a war cabinet that's been formed. The operation will unfold in the next few weeks. But longer term, he's going to face a lot of criticism.
Yeah. I mean, of course, he'll blame it on lack of intelligence, not my fault, Gov. You know, did these people not know? But, you know, the buck stops with him. Now, he's the great comeback kid of Israeli politics. He's Teflon Bibi, written off many times, comes back. If this war does not go as well as Israel wants it to go, I don't see how he survives it. Even if it does go well from the Israeli perspective, he will struggle to survive this. There are too many people that have lost too many relatives in the circumstances we know of, I think, for him to survive it. But as I said, if the war went well for them, that would be the only thing that could potentially and only potentially save him. But certainly a generation of people in intelligence and military and possibly elsewhere, a whole raft of them are going to go out. Martin, there is something I want to talk about if we have time. Mm. It's something I might try and write about this week. And it's a question that I think some people will be asking themselves, and that is about how the people that came across the fence could act in the way that they could act. Mm. And it's a really difficult and sensitive question because they are human beings the way that other people are human beings. So how on earth can they do what they've done to the women, to the children, to the men? And I've been troubled by this, but it is also something I've been following for many, many years. I think many of them will have been on drugs. But even so, they are people who from birth have had their heads filled with utter, utter poison. I mean, mm-hmm. I can give you chapter on verse on what they are told in their mosques, in the radical mosques. I'm not saying in all mosques by any means. I follow this stuff. The language is of the filthy Jew, the dirty Jew. They are pigs and animals. They are subhuman. They are not, worthy. They only exist to be killed. You've got Nasrallah in Hezbollah, for example, who is on record as saying, the only good thing about the state of Israel is that all the Jews have been gathered there, which saves us the trouble of hunting them down all over the world. This is the mindset.
Mm.
And if you have that mindset of regarding your opponent as subhuman, and this is a bit where I might lose half the other half of your audience. If they have existed in the harsh conditions of A, occupation, and B, blockade, whether you think it's right or wrong, and of course they don't think it's right, you put all that together, and these people go across, having been told since they were little children, that the people they're facing are not even human and are only there to be slaughtered. And so the people behind all that, that feed them that from birth, they have a responsibility in this. It's a very sensitive subject because you have to talk about it and make clear you are not talking about the religion. You are talking about a strand of it. But people for a long time, people like, well, let's not get too political, but some of our politicians who have said things like, you know, we're all Hamas now. They don't seem to understand that Hamas teaches people this sort of filth. Mm. They don't understand, to be perfectly honest with you, what they're dealing with. And it's such a difficult subject, but I did want to raise it at the risk of raising people's ire.
Well, final question. Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the demonstrations this week in the UK, which I've certainly found shocking. You know, if there is a time for, yeah. If people have pro-Palestinian view, whatever that means, because of course Hamas and Fatah are different from other organizations, and then there are Palestinians who are not members of any of those organizations. But anyone regarding themselves as pro-Palestinian to choose the aftermath of what just happened as a time to turn out on the streets in Manchester or Liverpool or London or anywhere else and think that this is about solidarity rather than obviously the moment to commemorate and to be appalled by what just happened. I find it shocking, but should I be shocked?
Yes, but not surprised, because you've seen it before.
Yeah,
over the years. I mean, I was struck by, for example, at Harvard University, Amnesty International's student group there has added its name to a long list of student bodies that are saying every single death that happened in Israel on Saturday is the fault of the Israeli government.
Extraordinary.
And it is partially student politics. I think there's various things going on. There are the people who are simply so radical and radicalized that they genuinely hate Jews, and they know what they're doing, and they know exactly what things like from the river to the sea means, which means the murder of millions of Jews, mm-hmm. essentially. They know that, and they don't care, and they're happy to go ahead of it. And then with them are what I often call Osama's useful idiots. And then there's this sort of the student types who simply don't understand. When they say something like, by all means necessary, I don't think that would stand up to a 5-minute debate if you put it to them, okay, so I'm going to give you this scenario, you know, of a baby having its throat cut, you know, so that is okay. That's by any means necessary. But it's such a cool slogan. And they're not adult enough or sophisticated enough to realize exactly what it is that they're saying when they say this cool, you know, by any means necessary, which of course was the old Malcolm X saying, I believe. And then you've just got these, you know, it's just utter sort of naive people who simply don't know the both sides of the story. Now, I think it's pretty obvious to listeners that, you know, I hold certain views on this. I mean, I've got a lot of Palestinian friends. I've got a lot of friendships from time spent over there. Ditto the other side. But I just don't think people understand what this one side's heads are filled with, and how the other side, not talking about this weekend, there is one fault I would say with Israeli society, and that is that they thought they had locked the door and thrown the key away, and they weren't even thinking about Gaza. Out of sight, out of mind. And I'll end, because I know we're running out of time on this point. Well, they've realized that they didn't lock it, and that it's not out of sight and out of mind. And this is the biggest problem coming up. We're going to see some incredible violence. And what is the end to it? The end is to smash Hamas. I think this might be the end of Hamas. But is it the end of the ideology that drives Hamas? And will we just get Hamas part two? Donald Rumsfeld, during Iraq invasion, during the American drone strikes against ISIS, he said, are we creating more terrorists than we're killing? And this goes to the biggest question about what happens over the next few weeks. And I think they may well be able to take out Hamas, but I'm not sure they can take out the ideology until there is some sort of solution. At the best, they're going to buy themselves another decade.
Tim Marshall, thank you very much for joining me on the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want my newsletter and Tim's brilliant weekly column on geopolitics and lots more from the Reaction team, visit the website www.reaction.life and you can become an annual subscriber for £80 or for the year or £8 per month. Until next time, thank you for listening.